My name is Hal Hendrick. I'm 74 years old, and today is October 4th, 2007. I am in Baltimore, Maryland, at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel. And my partner here is a close friend and colleague in the field of human factors or ergonomics.
And my name is Richard Hornick. I'm 72 years old. Today's date is October 4th. We're in Baltimore, Maryland, for the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society's 50th anniversary meeting. And the individual I'm interacting with is a colleague and friend, Hal Hendrick.
Richard, I want to ask you a question. I just finished being in a session where we were dealing with the issue of professionalism, and one of the questions that came up there was, what do you call yourself? It seems like many people in our profession call themselves different things, and I'm curious about what when you identify yourself professionally in your private practice, what do you call yourself?
Well, I'm asked that question frequently because I am in depositions because I do a fair amount of litigation work as an expert witness in the field of human factors, and my response to that always is I'm a human factors specialist.
Yeah, I tend to identify that way, too, either as a human factor specialist or as an ergonomist, although there are times, because I also have a background in industrial psychology, that if I'm dealing more with a client where my role is that of a consultant in organizational behavior, for example, I will identify myself as an industrial and organizational psychologist as well. But in my ergonomics work, I identify myself like you do.
Well, it's interesting. Don't you find that attorneys in general, though, are more conversant with using the term human factors rather than ergonomics, that you have to kind of add ergonomics as an adjunct to that?
Yes, particularly, as you know, we both do work as expert witnesses, and when I am involved as an expert witness, more often it's the term human factors. Because that seems to connote to attorneys and to juries a broader spectrum than ergonomics, which they think of more of, I think of as in a much more narrow form, such as dealing with the physical design of the seat you're sitting in or something like that, even though we know it's much broader than that.
Well, that's interesting because my experience is that attorneys usually are looking for human factors kinds of testimony, but when I'm on the stand in a trial, I will add the term ergonomics to help explain it to the jury, and they seem to be more receptive to the term ergonomics, and they start nodding their heads because of the term being used in a lot of advertising, ergonomically designed furniture, ergonomically designed cars, or whatever. And then they seem to be able to make that association with ergonomics to human factors.
Right. I have the same experience, particularly since in recent years the advertising industry has found out that this is a good buzzword to sell products, whether or not it's actually ergonomically designed, of course.
That's
if you've got a chair and you can adjust something on it, then it's ergonomically designed as far as they're concerned,
yeah.
Even though we know that's not what makes a chair ergonomic.
We know it's overused and misused.
Right. But I do the same thing you do now. I also use both terms when I explain myself to a jury so that they get a better sense of the total discipline.
Well, we've both been involved in this discipline for many, many years, and I think we all have different ways of how we got into the field. And I think I've related to you in other situations how I got into it, but how did you actually find your way into this practice?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think particularly those of us in our age group, when we got into the discipline when it was still quite early, because our discipline is only about, 60 years old now. It began really in World War II. And when I started out, my major undergraduate degree was in psychology, and I thought I was going to go into that field probably as a social psychologist because that was really what my background initially was. And I was in the Air Force doing my obligatory term after having taken ROTC during the Korean War. Back when I was in ROTC, when I was an undergraduate student at Ohio Wesleyan University, you either were in ROTC or else you had a 99% chance that you're not going to get through college before you get drafted. And so I did, and then I had to do my obligatory term. And about the time I was finishing up my 3 years of active duty in the Air Force, the Air Force offered me an opportunity to go to Purdue University to this new program they had called Human Factors. And so I said, well, what's that? and then they explained to me what it was. I said, gee, that sounds pretty interesting. And so what I did, I accepted a regular commission in the Air Force at that time and went to Purdue and got my master's degree in the field and then started working in it and then later came back to Purdue and got my doctoral degree in industrial psychology with a minor in industrial engineering at Purdue. Of course, I know you and I just missed each other as fellow students at Purdue University. And so, like many people, I sort of backed into the discipline one way or another, and that's the way I happened to have backed into it. And I'm very, very happy that that happened to me because I think it's been a wonderful, wonderful career. And it's great to wake up every morning knowing that you're in a discipline where what you're doing betters the human condition in some sort of way, makes life easier for people or safer for people.
How did they explain it?
Well, they said that what I was told was that we have been having a lot of failures of our missile programs. This was in the early days back in the 1960s when NASA and the Air Force were really in the early stages of course, our moon exploration program and the missile program. And they said that we have found that the major causes of these accidents are design-induced human error. And so what we need to do in the Air Force is to train people professionally that can work on the design and development of these programs so as to eliminate design-induced human error. And they explained that it was kind of a combination of psychology and engineering, and that would be the kind of curriculum that I would be taking.
Yeah, Hal, you just used the term design-induced human error. And I don't know if everybody is very familiar with that term. We are, of course, because that's part of what we do in our profession, is attack design-induced human error. But
Rich, I wonder if I could give an example of that I was given. In World War II, we had over 2,000 multi-engine aircraft accidents that was caused by one specific design feature, and that is that the landing gear lever and the flap lever were identical in shape. They were placed very close together, side by side, down to the side of the pilot's seat. And in landing the aircraft, where the pilot was looking out the window to land, they'd reach down and they'd grab the wrong lever, and it ended up in the crash. That one little thing, because they failed to recognize that they were putting a demand on the individual which exceeded our ability to make the discrimination. The controls were too close together. They were the same shape, so there was no way to discriminate while you're looking out the window and reaching down for it. And that actually was one of the things that initiated the initial research in our discipline to bring in engineering psychologists, or what they called at that time engineering psychologists, to look at it. And what they decided after looking at a lot of different aspects of the design of cockpits of airplanes was that that it wasn't pilot error, it was engineering design error, because they failed to consider human capabilities and limitations. Hence, the design induced the error.
Yeah, that's correct. And I am very familiar with that concept, of course. And one of the earliest cases that I got involved in as a human factors expert witness involved that very thing of very significant design-induced human error to the point of a fatality of a pilot, where in an aircraft, a fighter aircraft, the pilot wanted to refuel and wanted to extend the refueling probe from his aircraft to the tanker flying in front of him. And location of the refueling probe control switch was off to his side and slightly behind in what we'd call a blind area. And it was right next to the ejection switch as well. That both were identically shaped, closely positioned, and instead of extending the refueling probe, he ejected and was killed in the process. Very significant design-induced error. And very often we see in newspaper reports about an aviation accident that it was pilot's error. The term is still used without further analysis on the part of the reporter that, in fact, this pilot error might have been caused by the way things were designed to be used in the cockpit.
Right. I had a personal experience when I was in the Air Force. My first assignment was as a what we call a radar controller. That is that we would I was stationed at Montauk Point Air Force Base, and our job was to monitor all aircraft coming toward the United States, and we had to positively identify them. And if we didn't have a flight plan for them, then we had to scramble, what we call scramble the fighter, out of a military base, in this case Suffolk County Air Force Base, to go make an intercept and make a positive identification. And after we had done that, one cold December morning about 3 a.m., I was directing the plane using my radar scope back into Suffolk County Air Force Base, and he was coming in from the south of Long Island, heading due north to land, and I told him to call when he passed through 10,000 feet coming down. And he called at 10,000 feet, and that was the last time I heard from him. Well, we found the wreckage. He was killed, of course, about where we found it on the beach below Suffolk County Air Force Base. It was clear he was only at 1,000 feet. I later found out that what had happened is that this particular fighter aircraft, that they put a new type of altimeter in it. You know, the classic old altimeters had three needles on them. One was a short one that read 10,000 feet. They had a medium-sized pointer that read 1,000 feet, and they had a long one that read 100 feet. And so the pilot had to integrate that information. Well, as you and I well know, people are very, very poor at doing that kind of integration. So they looked for a different type of altimeter, and they decided to take the 10,000-foot pointer off and put a odometer-type reading for the 10,000-foot so that it would lessen somewhat the integration task for the operator. What they forgot about is that they had these pilots that were highly overtrained on the three-pointer altimeter, and what happened is in the stress of landing this plane, it was fogged down to the ground, coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the winter, he reverted back to his previously learned way of doing things and interpreted that altimeter as though it were a three-pointer. So he read the short pointer as being 10,000 feet when it was really 1,000 feet in that particular case. And as you and I know, a lot of the cases that we've run into are the same kind of what we call negative transfer of training, where you've learned on one type, they've made some kind of a modification to it without considering what the knowledge and background of the people are. And if it's too close in design to the old design, then you end up with a situation where the individual can easily make a mistake. And we've got loads and loads of war stories like that.
And that's correct. The thing is, it doesn't apply only to aircraft or military situations. I think probably most people recognize that they do things incorrectly and to the cause and effect that they didn't really want to have happen, and it's because of what they encountered, whether it's a toaster control or control on a video entertainment set, and you end up maybe turning something off that you really wanted to turn on, and stovetops are a great illustration of that. Even today, even after all these years of the existence of this discipline, you'll still find stovetops where the person that's going to use the stovetop doesn't turn on the correct control, doesn't turn the correct control to get the right burner on, and sometimes that results in burns, of course, because they think that they've turned on the rear burner and they might put their hand on the forward one that they've actually turned on, and it's because of the design of the layout, the way the controls and the resultant association with the burner were laid out.
I still do that with my own stovetop very frequently.
Yeah, it's when my wife and I did some remodeling in our home, we picked out a stovetop and I found one and chose one precisely because the controls and the burners association and the little warning lights in terms of what was turned on or what was hot were beautifully laid out. So there's examples of very good product design.
As well as very poor. Right. Yeah. Rich, I know you asked me about my background, how I got into the business, and I know you've told me before, but refresh my memory. Tell me how you backed into this business.
Actually, backed in is a pretty good term, because I really did not intend to go into the field of human factors. I knew nothing about it, really, when I was growing up. When I was in college, I went to school at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and my intent was to go to medical school. And Marquette at that time had a 3-year program where you didn't have to get a bachelor's degree. You just had to have a heavy science load and successfully deal with those and then do the medical admissions test to get in a 3-year program to Marquette's medical school. Well, I did just fine in all my courses except my third year. Last semester I decided to take an advanced course in organic chemistry, which I didn't really have to take, but I was also taking 3 other lab courses that were all high demand kind of situations, and I really messed up in the organic chemistry. Something had to suffer, you know. So of course I did take the test. I mean, I got my appropriate D, as it is. It might have been a C, but it was not an acceptable grade to have to try to go into medical school. And so after I had went through the test, I got a note from the dean of the medical school that I was not going to be accepted under the 3-year program. Because of that, and the dean, who was a woman, invited me to come in to talk about it, and we did talk about it, and she said, well, you know, just take your fourth year, and if you do reasonably well, we can virtually guarantee that you'll be admitted to medical school because you did fine on everything else. Well, in that fourth year, there was a professor there that offered me an assistantship to help him with his experimental psychology course in setting up laboratory equipment for experiments, correcting tests, or occasionally taking over a test if he was out of town, a class. Got really interested in experimental psychology during that process, and so I didn't even reapply to the medical school after my fourth year. I applied to several schools that had good experimental psychology programs, and Purdue was, of course, one of those. And it was a good combination since I lived in Milwaukee. Yet it wasn't too far from home. It wasn't like going to Penn State or something like that. And, of course, in the experimental psychology program, was exposed to some leaders in the human factors field, notably Ernest J. McCormick, who obviously you know very well.
Since he was both of our major professors.
And so I got influenced into what was at that time called human engineering, pretty predominantly in this professional area. And I just kind of wandered into it. So after leaving Purdue, I took a position that was essentially doing research with the environment of whole body vibration on human performance, and that's how I got into the field.
Uh-huh. Who would you say had the most influence on your life in the process of growing up and ultimately ending up in this discipline?
But that's a toughie. I knowing that we were going to be talking this morning, and that might come up, I was trying to think who really has significantly influenced me. And the problem with that for me is that there's not a single individual that stands out. There were several people that influenced me significantly. My personal life, I have close friends that I've had at different stages in my life that influenced me, and fortunately, mostly for the better. And in my educational life, there were certain professors, not just a singular one. If I named a singular one, I would be discrediting others or not giving them proper credit. And the same thing in my adult professional life. I've got several close friends, and obviously you are one of those very close friends. And I've been influenced happily by many people. I really cannot just say, okay, this is the person, even in each of those domains, that say, okay, this was the most significant person.
Now, I think about that myself. I'd start with my mother because she did have a lot of influence on me. But then I can think of a couple of people, though. Like you, there's no one person. I think about my high school homeroom teacher and geography teacher who had a lot of influence on me growing up. and my principal of my high school, who was a great principal and really encouraged me. When I first started out in school, I was a slow learner. I was a slow developer, but he had a lot of personal confidence in my ability and gave me that confidence to go on. And the further I went, the better I did in school. And so that was certainly a strong influence on me. And then, of course, we start getting into the professional area, and it was people like Harry Barrick at Ohio Wesleyan University, who is a famous now learning psychologist. But in that day, he was working with two pioneers in our field, Paul Fitz and George Briggs at Ohio State. And my first real exposure to ergonomics was before I ever knew the term, or human factors, and that was doing a research project with Harry and Paul and George Briggs. But then later on, it was people like Arnold Small, of course, a pioneer in our field, and he was my first department head when I joined the University of Southern California, and obviously has a lot of influence on a lot of us in this discipline. But like you say, there's many, many others, too. But those are some that immediately came to mind for me.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Arnold Small, because he's one of those special people that influenced my professional career as well. Arnold Small, a former president of the Human Factors Society, one of the founders of that helped formulate the Human Factors Society, as it was called then, Human Factors and Ergonomic Society now. And I was fortunate enough to live in the same city that he lived in, back in Southern California, a town called Fullerton. And we'd get together for lunch on occasion, or I'd go visit him at his home. And what was interesting about Arnold was that he might be gardening out in the backyard, and when I pulled up, even unexpectedly, to drop off a book or whatever it was, he'd be out there with his bow tie on and a kind of a formal shirt. You know, I never saw him in a t-shirt. Uh-huh. He was always dressed for the occasion, as it were. And of course, he was such a prominent person in our field that the society's most prestigious award that is given every year is named the Arnold Small President's Distinguished Service Award.
For which you and I are both honored to have received.
That's right. And that was the highest honor I've ever felt or experienced.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something that my grandchildren have been asking me, and that is, Grandpa, how do you describe what you do?
Yeah, that's a toughie, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a toughie because trying to explain the field of human factors is a little tricky, even if you're sitting, let's say, in an airplane next to a person and you start talking about what you do, and you say, well, I'm a human factors person, or I work in the field of ergonomics, and they look at you with this quizzical, what the heck is that? And of course, in the Human Factors Society officers' meetings, the topic always comes up about what's a 10-second or a 30-second explanation of the field kind of thing, the elevator question kind of thing. Can you answer the question before the elevator gets to the floor that you're going to?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, if one of my grandkids asked me that question, and they have in different ways, I try to do it at a very simple level, like, hey, Chaz, what I do is really try to make things better for humans to use. I try to work with people that design things so that they're safe to use, so that it won't hurt you. And that's the simplest way I can do it at the grandchild level. Obviously, when we're asked, let's say, by an attorney in a deposition, we go into much more detail about talking about human performance capabilities and limitations and perceptual processes and intellectual processes like decision making and information processing and so on. So, excuse me, I guess I took a long way around to answer your question relative to grandkids, but to young people, it's basically saying, hey, the objective of all of us in this field really is to make things safe for people to use.
Yeah, I tend to start by saying I work on the design of things to fit people, and then go into a little bit about, you know, to make it. And what I mean by that is so that they are more usable, they're safer to use, more comfortable, and so that it betters the quality of their lives.
You know, just thinking back to what we were talking about earlier about people who influenced our lives, and I believe that you also had a professor at Purdue by the name of Carol Wissiger, didn't you?
Oh, I did have Wiz, right.
And I don't know how he influenced my life other than, you know, making me more conversant with human learning theory, but...
As well as a lot of four-letter words.
That was somebody that you will never forget.
That's right.
His delight actually was to... since, let's say, you'd had a learning course seminar in which there were... or a course over a semester in which maybe there might be 10 or 12 males and 6 or 8 females. And in the classes, starting right from class 1, he would start using those four-letter words constantly. It, actually, to the point where I used to use a notebook, I probably could still find it somewhere in a, you know, file out in the garage, where I would use those four-letter words. I'd put them on the left side of the page, and then I'd put a little mark next to each one of those words to see at the end of that two-hour session how many times he had used those four-letter words. And what would happen is at that time it was a little bit unusual to use four-letter words in front of women. But the women will gradually, within the first few classes, start leaving and dropping the course. And sometimes they would go to the chair of the department and complain, but nothing was ever done about it. And after about 3 or 4 classes, there are no more women in the class. And then he would say, okay, guys, now that we've got the gals all out of here, we can get down to serious business.
Except he said it a little more colorfully. He was just a very small, slight of build guy. I don't.
Yeah,
he in terms of his looks, but obviously back in those days, his level of sexism would not go over very well. These days,
he didn't think ergonomics is something for women. Why not?
Well, his area was learning, and it was not that. He just felt that women shouldn't be doing this stuff. It was a man's business.
Yeah, I guess I never knew what the source of his antagonism towards women were, but he may have felt that they didn't really belong in a path that led to master's or PhD degrees. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just speculating.
That would be my speculation as well.
Yeah, there's some people you just don't forget. Yeah.
Actually, it was interesting when you look at early on, there were very few women in our discipline. And I think there was that kind of an attitude that more than just was had about the field. But it's interesting that's so totally changed now. In fact, I think we have more women in our educational programs than we do males getting their advanced degrees in human factors and ergonomics.
And that's actually true in the leadership of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society as well. Some years ago, I'd say maybe a dozen years ago or so, there was a small movement within the society led by one or two women that felt that they were underrepresented in the leadership of the society. And they even held meetings to try to see what they should do as a group of women in order to force change. Well, fortunately, somebody started gathering the information, and it turns out, and it is still true today, that actually women are overrepresented, if you will, in terms of the number of offices they've held at the executive council level.
That's true.
Compared to the male population of the society.
Mm-hmm. I think the nature of our discipline, it makes sense to me that this of the engineering or design-related disciplines, why... perhaps we get more women in this discipline than some of the traditional engineering areas do because of the nature of the work itself, and it so directly relates to bettering the human condition.
Well, yes, and I guess that's kind of the nature of our profession is you're trying to do something for the betterment of humankind, and I suppose if we're going to be sexist at all, we have to say that women tend to be mothering, nurturing kind of people, and therefore... are probably more concerned with caregiving than the male typically is. But our profession obviously attracts many males, that's what really makes it satisfying to me. You mentioned the fact that you are happy doing what you're doing, and I have the same feeling. Even though I intended to go into medicine to start with, I'm glad that turned out the way it did, because I really enjoy helping get bad things from being designed or getting things that are dangerous for people off of the market and that kind of thing. And early in my career, I belonged to many societies, such as Society of Automotive Engineers, or IEEE, an engineering society, or System Safety Society, and so on, and American Psychological Association as well. One by one, I started dropping my memberships without really knowing why I was, but I was less and less interested in these other concentrated activity areas. And the one that I really remained closely aligned with was the Human Factor Society, because of the fact that the people within it were all oriented to, or let's say almost everybody was oriented towards, the betterment of things for humankind.
Uh-huh.
And it drew positive people that I cared about, because they had similar kinds of values.
I think that's kind of how, when I originally went to Ohio Wesleyan University, I thought I was going to become a Methodist minister at the time.
Oh, really?
And I don't know whether you knew that about
me.
No, that's why I went to Ohio Wesleyan, because they graduated more Methodist bishops than any other school in the country.
I did not know that.
And but then, of course, I got in there, and I finally decided that I wanted to go into that, not because of the theistic aspects of religion, but because of the do-gooder part, that is, wanting to be of help to people. Then I discovered psychology when I started taking my psychology courses. And so it was sort of filling the same need to want to do something to help people, to better the human condition. So obviously then getting involved in human factors and ergonomics was just a natural outcome of that as well. And so it's been so tremendously satisfying. Given your age and maturity and experience, what do you think are the major lessons you have learned in your life?
Well, I guess I have learned things through the years, and I wasn't always a very calm individual. I like to think I'm mostly calm now. I learned that it was a desirable characteristic to really listen to people, to not just be there to talk about yourself and try to persuade somebody to believe the same way about the things that you yourself did, not meaning you, but me. Reality is that I think I'm a different person than I was when I was much younger, because I was much more impetuous when I was younger. I took things sort of at face value without questioning very much, and now I like to consider what I'm hearing, for example, or the source, where it's coming from. I try to be more evaluative, and I think that's who I've become, is a person that I probably would have liked to have been when I was younger, but wasn't. And I don't know if that's getting older or getting wise, but I certainly am not as impetuous or risk-taking, for example, either. I used to climb the highest trees and lean over the cliffs and all waterfalls and that kind of thing. Now I won't get 10 feet off the ground. I mean, my neighbor has to help me put Christmas tree lights up on my roof.
I share that.
So do you feel like you've changed quite a bit through the years?
Or? Yeah, as I asked you the question, I was thinking about my own response to that. The first thing that occurs to me is the fact that when I was younger, I think I was, first of all, I was kind of more concrete in my thinking. That, by that I mean, I sort of saw there was a certain way you had to do things, and you had to be conforming to that, and that's the way the world was, and that if you deviated from that, or if I knew somebody deviated from that, it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the biggest learning lessons I have is, as I've become more experienced and more abstract in my thinking, is almost the reverse of that attitude. You know, that I'm far, far more open to differences in perception, differences in people's experiences, And then the way that they see life, the way they think things. One of the things that's helped greatly, I think, is things like traveling and, you know, and going to other countries and where you get a different perspective even of your own country and your own culture and are able to perhaps evaluate it a little more critically as a part of that. When I was at the Defense Race Relations Institute, which was a very intense situation as the director of the behavioral science part of that program, just the exposure that I got to people from all different educational groups, different racial groups, different ethnic groups, was a tremendous learning experience in terms of becoming more open and essentially more aware, I think, of both the commonalities as well as the differences in people and appreciating those things. So I would say that would be probably the major area in which I've changed. I think the things that I've had reinforced, for example, is that in being in leadership positions, that you can't just be a good person to everybody. I tried to be a good guy to everybody when I was younger, and I began to realize that when you do that, you don't express your opinions openly, and I found that I didn't when I was younger. And I had a fraternity brother in college come up to me and he said, you know how? He said, you'll never be the head of this fraternity because you try to be friendly to everybody and you don't say what you really think. And so, you know, you're not very interesting. And that was an eye-opener for him because I realized that that was true. And then when I got into positions like being a... I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, working on the design of systems where I had project engineering responsibilities, and then when I was a department chair and then as a dean of a college, I realized that that wasn't the way to be effective as a human being, that I had to really do what in terms of leadership we would call, you have to be considerate and empathic with people, treat them with respect, but you also have to provide structure and you have to make hard decisions sometimes. And you have to express your own honest opinions. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be really liked by anybody. You're much more, even if people disagree with you, they can still respect you and like you because you're being honest and direct with them. And I think that was the other huge change that I had to make in my life from when I was younger as I got older.
Well, that reminds me of a development period in my life as well, and that was at in my undergraduate school at Marquette, Marquette, of course, being a Jesuit university. And the Jesuits are known as being kind of the teaching, the educational center within the Catholic Church. I was kind of a stubborn questioner of just about everything when I was a kid. And when I got to the Jesuit education part of my life, that was reinforced. It was their whole philosophy was, don't just take things at face value. Do question. If you've got questions, that doesn't make you a bad person, which is sort of aligned with if you're questioning and you therefore have your own basis of belief, which then gives you a basis for having opinions that you can express to others. So I think that was something that helped me interact with people in a way that you're talking about, where you're able to express what you believe strongly because you do believe strongly.
Right. To tag on that, the other thing that came to my mind is I had strong beliefs, but the other thing I also learned was that when you get into a discussion of an issue, let's say you and I were dishing on a thing, it's not because I have to convince you that you're right and I'm wrong. I mean, I'm right and you're wrong. It's rather that you've had a different set of experiences than I have, and that I can hear what you have to say, and that may or may not change my opinion, but it gives me the opportunity to consider things that I might not have considered before. And I don't have to convince you to change your mind. You don't have to convince me to change mine, but I get the benefit of your experiences, which may help me refine my own thinking.
Well, I understand what you're saying. Fortunately, both you and I have served on the Executive Council for many, many years, and most of the time I think we have had agreement in terms of the issues and positions that have been discussed at council, but that was not always the case, obviously. You had some opinions on one side of the fence and I on the other.
Sure.
Yet we always respected each other's positions. I know we'll talk about that later. I think that your comment right now is a good note to end this little discussion on, that we both have strong beliefs. Most of the time they coincide, and when they don't coincide, we respect each other's position and thoughts.
Right.